Hello and welcome to Our Dad's Died with me, Tom.
And me, Rich.
This is a podcast of people who like death, enjoy death, want to be part of the realm of death.
That's not how we'd normally say it, I don't think. I don't think this is the podcast for people who want to be part of the realm of death.
The conversation.
This podcast brought to you by Dignitas is for people who long for the sweet, cold embrace of death itself. This is the podcast for people who have experienced death secondhand, I suppose, is maybe the way we'd say it. If you've lost someone that you loved or just liked or knew, or if you're just vaguely interested in what it's like to go through that, this is the podcast for you. Our Dad's Died and Our Dad's Died. This week, we have got the superb comedian Darren Griffiths joining us. Darren's someone we've been trying to get on the podcast for a long time. I think I spoke to Darren about coming on in Edinburgh last year, last August, and we kept setting up different recordings, and then they kept falling through for various reasons, our reasons, his reasons, and then eventually we finally got him on a few months ago, and it was a great interview. One small caveat is some tech issues.
Few tech issues.
Couple of tech issues with Darren. So the audio that you're hearing is not quite as high quality as the audio that we'd normally put out. We have to use the recording of the Zoom interview. So it's not our best audio-wise. Content-wise, it's up there.
It's a banger.
I think it's up there. And it doesn't detract from the enjoyment of the episode.
Yeah, you get used to it.
But to give you a little bit of context before we begin, we got Darren on the Zoom. He couldn't speak for quite a long time. His microphone wouldn't work. Then after about 20 minutes of that, we got him on. He started talking. It started going really well. And then we'll join you back again in the middle of this episode to explain a little mishap. Right, well, welcome to the podcast, Darren Griffiths.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. You're very welcome. How did your dad die? There we go, straight in.
There you go, straight in.
I should explain that there was a little moment before we started recording where we set up that Darren's listened to the podcast, and I said, well, then we can just get straight in. Because I realise now that without that bit on the recording, it sounds like I'm very blunt.
Yeah, but now it's turned into one of those rambly cold starts again, whereas, you know, because so much chat is happening.
Oh yes, let's
people
go
just
want to
know the facts. So,
go. How did dad die?
Dead. How?
Go. So it was when I was eight years old, and it was via the Big C. Big C. Ooh, old cancer. Oh, the old crabby cells got him. I remember it was 4 days, which was always fun, and
it was. Wait, yeah. Sorry.
4 days before Christmas, December 21st.
Wow! Yeah.
So, pretty strong for an 8 year old to deal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to one up you, but 23rd of December here, so 2 days before Christmas.
Now you beat me. Look, the facts are the facts, Rich.
Yeah,
but Rich was a full.
To be fair, I was 24 years old, so it feels like Christmas should have mattered less to me by that point than it would have done to you as an 8 year old.
Well, here's the thing. The same day, it was actually a friend's birthday at school, birthday party. And I remember obviously finding out, my mum coming downstairs and telling me, breaking the news to me. Actually, let me tell it in proper story mode. So I remember my dad was ill, but obviously when you're 8 years old, you don't really have a conception of, you know, your dad actually dying or any of your parents dying. So he was ill, visibly ill, and then I remember I was out with my mum and my godfather, and I remember getting into the house, phone ringing, my mum going upstairs, picking up the call, and then I just remember her just letting out this kind of scream, and then looking at my godfather, and he's looking at me, a laugh. In hindsight, I look back, I mean, Jesus Christ, that must have been awkward for him. Because he's got just looking at me like, oh shit, I know what this is. Does he know what this is? And then I remember my mum was trying to buy a car at the time. And I remember saying to my godfather, oh, maybe she didn't get the car. And then he looked at me like, that is not it.
Wow. Like, you've misjudged the intensity of that scream by a number of levels.
So wide of the mark. She really wanted that Ford Escort. Like, so, and I remember her coming downstairs and breaking the news to me. I was very upset. And then I remember my sister consoling me. And my sister and I, we have different dads. She's older than me. And I remember her consoling me and just saying the most bratty thing an 8-year-old could say. I'll go, well, it's okay for you. Your dad's still alive.
Well, to be fair, I'm actually with 8-year-old you there. You know, she doesn't know what it feels like.
Yeah, and for her, she's like just poor, like, you know, feeling horrible for her little brother. And then, I just remember being downstairs and my mum going, oh, you know, I totally understand. I don't want to go to your friend's birthday today. And I was like crying. And I was kind of like rubbing my face. But no, I want to go to the party because there'll be cake and balloons. So I definitely want to go to the party. This has nothing to do with the party. I need to go. I remember attending the party, and then my friend Danny, who I'm still friends with now, headbutted me in the nose because he disagreed with my pronunciation of us. To this day, I still don't know which one he prefers, charades or charades.
Oh my god, what a,
now, this
what a
party
day.
was it in the Victorian era? How old are you? What happened there?
I'm only 36.
I think of 8-year-old birthday parties as Spider-Man, bouncy castles. I do not think of charades/charades.
Yeah, and to this day, I still have an anxiety about how to pronounce that word just before I say it. Because I just think of...
I feel like you've got hung up on completely the wrong detail there, though, Tom.
Yeah?
To hear that story and be like, what, you were playing charades at an 8-year-old's birthday party? So I think the bigger question is, so you didn't know that your dad was going to die. It came as something of a shock.
Yeah.
And then you went to a party on the same day.
Yeah, same day, yeah, because I died.
Bringing quite a weird vibe to the party, I'd imagine? Or?
No, it was like, even from that young age, I guess I still have it now, I have this weird kind of pragmatism of, well, he's not going to come back if I don't go to the party. I wanted the party, and that was kind of my attitude towards it. I thought I could be upset about this later.
Wow, that is very mature. It's like you went, you skipped the first four stages of grief immediately. It just went, well, that's acceptance then. He's gone. May as well get some cake.
Yeah.
I think that to me sounds like classic first stage of grief, doesn't it? Denial.
Maybe. Pure denial.
Classic denial. You just... All right, doesn't matter.
Yes, it
I've got a party to do. And then, you know, you carry on with the actual grieving later. And that seems to me.
No, and I think that's the crazy thing. Like, I always say to talk to my friends, you know, in my 30s now, so they're starting to lose, like, parents, and some of them lost them in their 20s. And one of the strange things I've realised is I think losing a parent when you're young, you're allowed to just kind of be upset. You don't have to be anything else. Like, I think when you lose a parent as an adult, you then have to immediately get into adult mode of who do I need to notify, the arrangements, what do I need to do? I need to arrange the burial or cremation, whatever it is. You have to do all of that and slip into this really adult, organized mode and almost park your grief. Whereas as a kid, I was just able to be upset and then go to school and start crying in the playground, and the dinner ladies would be sympathetic for that, or the teachers would be, and you'd be given time to, you know, just be upset at home, cry. It didn't matter. You're just allowed to just have this kind of outpour of emotion, and almost, they said, move down those steps of grief. But so yeah, it's a strange way of saying it, but I do feel there's a strange blessing towards in respect of losing the parent when you're younger rather than as an adult, I think.
Yeah, I do see what you mean, but I think there are also there are other challenges when you're 8 years old and losing your dad. At this exact moment, we lost Darren again. It's my fault. I, trying to be a true professional, I said to Darren, any chance you could pop some headphones on because it'll improve the audio? He couldn't put headphones into his iPad, so he had to move back to the laptop that had caused the previous issues. He moved back to the laptop. The previous issues started again. He came back onto the iPad. The previous issues persisted. So you're now joining us in a moment, roughly 25 minutes on from where we left off. It may seem seamless. It wasn't. I think we both sweated quite a lot. Darren, a father of two, a busy man, had a lot going on, and we were more than an hour into the record at this point and had got 10 minutes down.
And just forcing him to keep swapping between devices.
Entirely unnecessarily as well, making it completely worse every single time we tried to make it better.
Yeah. Whose suggestion was that?
Listen, it doesn't matter, I don't think. I'm pretty sure that bit's been deleted, so it doesn't really matter.
The ghost, I think.
Yeah. What needs to be said is that from here on out, it's plain sailing, baby.
Yeah.
All the way to the end. So let's get back into Darren, so to speak. Come on.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's get back into Darren.
We do... Okay.
Recording in progress.
We are back. Right. Okay, so.
Right, so charades or charades? Were we... what was it? Did we decide which one it was?
Was that there are different issues to losing your dad when you're eight, one of which we discussed in a small, what I like to think of as sort of an oxbow lake of the episode, where it took a detour that was recorded but that could never be put out. But we did get the bombshell that you didn't go to your dad's funeral.
No, so I didn't go. No, and it was. And I said, if it's. I remember being at school, the day of, and my mum coming in with my uncle, brother, and sister, and they kind of popped their head into the classroom. It's like, are you sure you don't want to come? And I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I don't want to come. And then immediately just being racked with guilt and regret that I didn't go. Like by lunchtime. Oh, no. I was just crying in the playground.
Oh, man. That's brutal. What was the reason that you didn't want to go?
I suppose it was just too much. It was like, it was just too sad. I think when you're 8 years old, well, I was nine by the time the funeral happened. Yeah, I was just like, I can just opt out of it being too sad. You don't have that kind of sense of duty, do you, when you're a child? Whereas I need to go and
I don't think respects. That was very fair of them to put that on you, Darren. I don't think that was very fair. You weren't in a position as a child to make that decision, I don't think.
No. It either should have been you're covered along and that's it, or you're not covered along and that's it.
So yeah.
Well, it's up to you. On your head be it.
Yeah.
It's the kind of, I hate to sort of rub salt into the wound, but it's the kind of decision that needs the firm hand of a father, really, isn't it? That if only there was someone there who could have put their foot down and said, show what, you should go.
Oh, I'll be your spot on there, Rich. Yeah, well,
but that's, I mean...
Darren, I feel so, I can't tell you how bad I feel. That sounds... awful. I mean, I'm so sorry. This podcast shouldn't be us telling our guests that their experiences are bad, and I've done this before. But I have like a secondhand almost feeling of stress and anxiety, and I don't know if our listeners are getting this, let me know, because at least that'll make me feel slightly better. But that sound, I mean, that makes me feel really sick, physically sick. That's awful, really, yes. Isn't it? That they, I mean... are you frustrated? Let's turn this into a question. Do you have any frustrations at your family God, please just tell me.
Not
tell me it's not as bad
as it sounds.
Not
told a story. Now I've already told a story. I now have vehement anger.
It's only just kicked in.
No, they just kicked in. It's like they did me wrong. No, I don't. I don't. I feel fine about it because I know it came from a good place in the sense of, you know, it's just a double check because there is a parallel universe where they don't check on me. And I'm now at school going, oh, I've made a mistake. I wish I went. I wish I went. I wish I went. I wish I went. And I wasn't given the opportunity to go. So, you know, it was very much presenting a way of going, you know, you don't have to come, but if you do want to come, you can still come. It's okay. Like, we've bought clothes for you if you do want to change your clothes and come. But if you don't want to come, it's totally fine. And then we'll see you later. And you know what I mean? It was way softer than I delivered it. But ultimately, yes, the decision was left to me as a 9-year-old whether I wanted to come.
Yeah, which seems like an oversight. It's interesting because I'm interested to see like what kind of relationship you had with your dad, because obviously you didn't know that you said you knew that he was ill because he looked ill, but you didn't know how ill he was. And then
and that was the first person I lost. And I lost like grandparents beforehand or anything. Yeah. So
presumably
you didn't really have any kind.
Did your mum knew that he was going to die? Or was it a shock to everyone?
Oh no, never really actually asked her that directly. Now I think about it, but I imagine so, because he was in a very bad way, like, you know, just weight completely drained, face gone, color gone from his face, kind of thing. For you know, a while he was like a kind of stocky guy, similar build to me, and just by the time that I last saw him, I say he was a 6-foot guy who's no light from no more than like 8 stone or something. Like,
wow.
Yeah, he was gaunt and stuff. So that's when it hit me as a kid to thinking, he's really ill. Because it's one of those ones where, you know, when you've got a relative who's in and out of hospital all the time. So you're going to visit your dad and he's like, oh, where is he? Yeah, he's flat. Oh, no, he's in St. Mary's in Paddington. You're like, oh, okay. And he just kind of shrug his shoulders. I've seen him in hospital before. It's not an issue because he comes out. That's not an issue. So to see him at his flat and see him so ill, I was like, oh, yeah, okay, he's ill. Kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
But I still didn't have the idea that he would go. Yeah.
Could you walk me through your family situation a little bit more? Because I'm a little bit confused by it. You said seeing him at his flat. Did you not live together?
Yes. No, so mum and dad were together until I was about maybe 6, I think, they were together. And then, and even when they were together, he still lived between his place in Northwest London and where I grew up in Essex.
Oh, right.
So he was always between the two. Yeah, he was just always between the two. So it was never odd for, like, there were so many times when me and my mum would go and stay at the flat in London, and then sometimes he would be at the house in Essex. So it would just be between the two houses. It's not quite holiday in the south of France, a holiday. He's between Harlow and Kilburn.
Second home. Yeah,
our listeners in London will enjoy that one, if nothing else.
And so, so by the time they'd, I was about 6 years old, they'd split. But but all through my life, I'd always been between the two houses.
And were you close with your dad?
Yeah, definitely. It's I think people see me when I was growing up after he'd passed. They'd obviously say I was a bit of a mummy's boy, but obviously they didn't have much of an option, right? Yeah. But before he'd gone, I'd definitely say I was a bit more for my dad actually than my mum. It was a strange one too. It was like, I think it's a typical thing. Your mum does all of the boring graft of a parent, and then that just gets all the kind of the plaudits, you know, getting to see him, because he was an entertainer, he was a singer, so he was, you know, he's away working, touring. So when I saw him, it was a big whee, it's fantastic, it's like he's here. Ignore the fact that my mum's looked after me day in, day out for like 2-3 weeks on her own. It's dad's back, yay.
Yeah. Comes in, steals the glory.
It was that. Yeah, exactly. I was close to him. typical thing of discipline in the sense of my mum would be telling me off all day, you know, just stop this, stop that, stop this, stop that. And then be the typical threat. All right, wait until I'll tell you, Dad. Carry on, I'll tell you, Dad, when you get home.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, shit. It's like, you just already know. He's like, oh, I've fucked it here. It's like, he's going to be fuming.
I think a lot of kids whose parents split have that kind of experience. I certainly did. Where throughout the week you're with your mum, and then at the weekend your dad, he takes you to Burger King, football in the park, maybe at the beach. You know, it's classic, all the main events, you know, highlight of your week.
Yes.
And then you go back with mum and it's, oh, you've got to do the washing up. And it's like, well, this is, I know who I prefer. right? One of them takes me to the arcade.
Yeah, no, exactly. No. My mum makes me eat proper dinner. My dad just looks at me and goes, would you like some pizza? Yes, yes, I would. Yeah, I actually love some pizza.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder, it seems, to be a good parent than a bad parent in terms of getting praised for it. Because if you're the, like, the weekend dad, like, it's the easiest job in the world.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily good parenting. You turn up, you do all the fun stuff, you let them stay up till 11, watch a horror movie, teach them to smoke, drop them off with their mum on the Monday, she takes them to school, does all the tough stuff, and then it's like, well, hey, fun dad again on Saturday. They're like a good dad. You only get your praise for it after the fact. Like, for good parenting, it's only when like a great artist years later you go, oh yeah, I see what he was doing there. Didn't appreciate it at the time.
Oh, 100%. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, definitely. Like, I will say, like, with my mum and dad, they weren't split out for a lot of my life. So, you know, I didn't have that full weekend dad experience, but it was way more fun when, that's what I say, it's way more fun. It's about, sometimes it wasn't, but what happened is my mum was leaning with the TV than he was. So I would always be able to watch whatever. So we had cable downstairs, so I would need that TV. Not want it, I would need that TV to watch the cartoons that I needed to watch.
Yeah.
And then when my dad was about, he'd be like, well, no, it's adult time now, so we're watching whatever. He's watching Columbo or the news.
Not the news.
The two adult shows.
Not the bloody news.
And what, the news, and what annoyed me.
Nothing worse than a Columbo omnibus, is there? Or a news omnibus, I suppose.
Exactly. And everything you'd want to watch would be on, at the time, the four channels. So I'm like, can't he just go upstairs and watch TV? But I never had the balls to actually say that to my dad, so I'd kind of hint that to my mum. That maybe you could suggest that dad goes upstairs to watch it, so I can continue watching Cartoon Network. And she'd be like, no. It's like, absolutely not.
Dad, may I prevent you with a deal? It's so true, though. My dad's the same thing. He was always watching football. If it was the television, it was Sky Sports, football, cricket, etc. That's what he would watch on the TV, which meant, you know, The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy is right out. That's not even a consideration. But of course, it was the downstairs television that gave you access to that. You could watch the FA Cup upstairs. It's so true. It's exactly that. You're so right.
I know. So, yeah, it was that. And then, yeah, like you said, Rich, yeah, being a dad myself, yeah, definitely getting insight into, you're a striker. You're in the box, 6-yard tapping merchant. As a dad, my wife has to deal with them all day, and then they're literally eating dinner that she's made, and then I come into the front door, and it's just like, oh, dad, running away from their food to come give me a hug. Yeah, our hero, he's back. Mom, dad's here. Like, they're literally looking at her, but why aren't you as excited as us? Like, I don't think you understand who just walks in through the front door.
So you then try and
it's fun being on the receiver.
Do you try and like give the plaudits then to your wife? Like, you know, when the cast come on at the end of a musical and they clap for the orchestra, is it a bit like you're then like, and kids also remember? Great work the mum did.
Yeah, no,
mum.
I'll give you a prime example of how much my daughter does not care for my wife at all. She's our eldest. So it was Mother's Day. And I said, here's a card. Give it to mommy. It's Mother's Day. And she gave the card. And my wife went, thank you. Is this for Mother's Day? And the daughter goes, no, 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 no. Daddy's Day. It's Daddy's Day. And
oh, no.
Like, no. It was like, it's Mother's Day. I was like, it's Mummy's Day. Like, and my wife said, yeah, it's Mummy's Day. She's like, nah, Daddy's Day. Very arrogant, like just dismissive. No, you've got it wrong, guys. It's Daddy's Day. And I was like, okay.
Well, if you say so, let's get me breakfast in bed.
Yeah. Exactly.
How have you found being a dad? Because I remember hearing a phrase once that somebody said, you if you lose your... what, like a parent, you grieve twice. You grieve when you lose them, and then when you become a parent, it's like a new wave of grief. Did you have any of that becoming a dad, or
maybe not? I think because there's quite a big gap between, you know, losing my dad and becoming a parent. So you know, I feel like say like to my relationship with Father's Day, for example, it was the day that I hated for a long time, as a kid growing up, just hated it, thought, it's annoying, it's rubbish, whatever, just all that kind of deflective bullshit you do as a man, rather than just say, I'm actually upset and I miss my dad.
just get
angry about it. And then I started doing mentoring, and one of the events was like a Father's Day event, and you were exactly going to this mentor event to show these kids who've made their dads run in their lives to be like, right, you know, we're good male role models and stuff. So then that kind of changed my perspective on the day. And then after that, having kids myself, it's then just was like, oh, Father's Day is just about me being a dad rather than me not having a dad. So it's I know, probably it's probably been quite, good in the sense of getting over it and, and grieving in that sense. I didn't feel like I grieved twice. So I think because it's been away for such a long time, it's never really crossed my mind of, oh, like my kids aren't ever going to get to meet him kind of thing, which is odd. I've never thought about it like that. But yeah, it's just something I've kind of come to terms, came to terms with before I even had children.
Yeah, I suppose when it's been... Because what age were you when you became a dad? It was fairly recent.
So 33 for my daughter and 35 for my son, so...
Yeah. And because you tried for quite a long time to become a dad. Is that right? That was sort of what your Edinburgh show was about.
Exactly what Edinburgh show was about. I tried my hardest to not just slip into PR mode there and worry the show. Yeah, actually, and if you want to listen to my show, Inconceivable. But yeah, that is what went through the journey through IVF to have kids. And I guess, that point was a bit of a weird dynamic to go through, in a sense of, I think I'd always told myself, that would be how I'll draw a line under losing my dad. I'll become a dad myself, and that's how I'll experience fatherhood, a father-child relationship. I'll have to just experience it as the father. And I've always got this weird complex about staying alive older than, so my kids are older than 8 years old, that's one, and then my dad died at 49, so I have to make it to 50 as well, then I've won.
Yes, you can never beat him at chess, but you can beat him at living. Let's go back to the funeral briefly. Obviously, for a lot of people, what the funeral at least is meant to represent is an opportunity to say goodbye. Whether it really functions that way for a lot of people, we've certainly found on this podcast, maybe not, but certainly it's meant to represent that. So not having that, I was wondering if at any point in your childhood you had some kind of event, or you remember doing something that felt like it was an act of saying goodbye?
So I've always been told when answering questions, if you don't overthink it, the first thing that comes into your mind is usually the truth. And the first thing that came to my mind was this. So let's give a bit of background. Although I'm from Essex, my dad was in Northwest London. He ended up being buried in Southeast London because the woman he was with at the time of dying, that's where she was from, and she ended up having all the deeds to his grave. So she decided he was going to be buried in Southeast London. So I didn't go to the funeral. So I first visited his grave a few weeks after the funeral, and that's when I was 9 years old. Then I attempted to go to the grave again when I was about 21. After that, I couldn't find the grave. Obviously, I couldn't find it because I hadn't been there since I was 9, and I really backed my memory to find it. So I didn't go till I was 9, and then couldn't find it, got very upset. And my then girlfriend told my mum where we'd been, what had happened. I didn't want her to tell her, but I guess I kind of did, because then we're all going, if you want to go to the grave, why just tell me? We'll go together. So me, my mum, and my cousin went. And when we went, obviously the first time I went, there was a temporary headstone. So I expected there to be like a big stone or marble headstone there. And all that was there was that same temporary headstone. And I was like, oh, right, they haven't fixed that. They haven't put a proper headstone on. And I was really upset, really angry about it. And then I went with my brother. No, sorry, I'm lying. That time I went with my brother. That was it. I went with my brother, who we have the same dad. So it's my mum and my brother. And I just remember how angry he was that it was a temporary headstone, that they hadn't put a proper headstone on, that the woman that had all the rights to the grave hadn't sorted it out. And that really bothered me for a long time, because now I'm not a kid, I'm an adult now. This is something I could actually be involved in. I didn't go to funeral, I didn't sort out anything for the funeral, but I could put some money aside and, you know, sort out the headstone. And then years just passed and years passed, and ironically, it was the same personal development course I did that made me start doing comedy. We had to do this exercise about, you know, an issue that we had or something that we hadn't forgiven ourselves for. And that was one of the things I hadn't forgiven myself for, was sorting out this headstone. And then I've kind of rationalized it. Well, the reason why he doesn't have a headstone is because he didn't, live his life in a way where he ended up being with someone that loved him enough to actually put a headstone on. I was trying to kind of rectify the mistakes he had made while I was alive. And so once I kind of let that go, after, you know, him not having a headstone, him having a headstone really doesn't have any bearing on our relationship or my memories of him. And it's not actually something I need to really get myself bogged down and emotional about. And once I did that, I was like, you know, there's nothing I can really do about it at this stage. And the only thing I can do about it is, you know, speak about him well when, you know, and just been speak about my memories of him fondly, which I do have amazing memories of him, and make sure that when I become a dad, that I live my life in a way that, you know, my kids or my wife send me off properly, and I pour enough love into them that they feel that's the only possible thing they can do when I die.
Do you still go to the grave ever, or?
I mean, well, last time I went, the temporary headstone had completely gone. So it's literally, I only know where the grave is just from memory. It's just literally a patch of grass.
So it's
there's an unmarked grave, completely unmarked grave. And like, so for someone who lived such an eventful life and had so many people who did love him, in the sense of my grandmother, his siblings, friends, my siblings, his kids, nieces and nephews. He lived his life in a way that towards the end, he ended up with someone that took his money and didn't, and that's all she cared about in the end, and didn't even have the dignity to give him a headstone.
Well, I would ask if you stayed in touch with her. Yeah. It's starting to sound like you might not have done.
No, because I was a kid. I was a kid, so I had no reason to stay in touch with her. It was only as an adult I realised, oh, that's who would have all those deeds to the grave. Yeah. And I thought, it's not.
I'll tell you what, Darren, it's starting to sound like way too good Edinburgh show to track her down. Getting my dad a headstone.
I do need a second show. Maybe we've got it. We've
it's a structure.
It.
It's a good narrative, isn't it?
It's also like a dark take on the Peter Kay buying my mum a bungalow, buying my dad a headstone. It's like the other side of the coin.
You know what? We might be there. I said I needed to go grief mining, trauma mining for the second show. So yeah. I was considering just taking up like a drug addiction and divorcing my wife. But I'm happily married and I don't like drugs. So yeah. Maybe this is the way to go.
That is an amazing story. The idea that, and the fact that it's affected the way that you've lived your life as well, that the sort of the memory of going to that grave and seeing it and then thinking, I'm not going to be like that.
Yeah, because like, I'm not a religious person, right? So, and I remember someone saying to me, you know, you die twice in life. So the first time you die is when you physically die. And the second time you die is when your name is said for the last time.
Mm.
And then when you think of it like that, you think, well, there's people who've got their names on buildings and bridges and in written in law. Those people, Jesus, he's pretty famous.
He's done well.
He's done all right. He's done pretty well. They'll be immortal. They'll always live. And their legacy will be what continues. So even if you're not famous worldwide, I mean, your family should know who you are. And I think one of those easy things to keep your name mentioned is having a headstone, at least, where someone walks past your grave and go, oh, that's so-and-so. That's where they're buried. So, I found it like a very harrowing thing to see that even if I was cremated, I'd like someone to, I don't know, put something on the wall to say, Darren lived here from this time to this time, even if I was cremated, but just have nothing physical there is, it was a bit like, I don't want that to happen to me. So, yeah.
You want to make some kind of mark, don't you? Quite literally, in that case. Yeah. You want to leave like an impact.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah,
and you said you have like, you obviously have great memories of your dad. What are the memories that you sort of most often go to when you think about him? Because it's quite a short space of time, 8 years.
Definitely. It's a very short space of time. But I think I can see the way I parent has been templated by how he parented in the sense of when it comes to discipline, he was the kind of most senior authority, but he wasn't doing the day-to-day discipline kind of thing. And he kind of just came in just to back my mom's decisions. And that's kind of with me, I'm the playful one for the kids. But then if my wife says something and my daughter turns to me, they just go, oh, you know, do I have to do that? I'm like, just listen to your mom. That's it. That's all I say. And then and that playfulness, and my memories were just him sitting there watching TV and never telling me to stop. When I was playing, like I remember I'd be literally crawling over him and on top of his head and just on top of him, just around him, and him just being completely unfussed by it, just being like, yeah, all right, you're on my head now, fine, brilliant. Just like it was never an issue. And it's just memories like that, and just very affectionate. I vividly can feel his like even at this age, feel his stubble against my face. And that, yeah, that's like a very, very visceral memory.
Mm.
And him just always saying, oh, so his nickname for me was Daddy's Little Superstar. That was it. That was his nickname for me. And that was in, I think there's a card at my mum's house that's got that written in it and stuff. So, yeah, it was that, just that kind of sense of just feeling protected and, yeah, so I'm just a strong man just there, just at home kind of thing. It was just, yeah, it's just nice feeling to grow up with and stuff. So, yeah, that's it. It's that I hope that make my kids, even at this age, have that kind of feeling towards me kind of thing, yeah.
It's interesting that kind of sense memory thing that you're saying about feet, like the feeling of his stubble and stuff, because I'd never thought about it before, but I have certain things from my dad that I can remember, like the physical feel of it. And one is like this, when I was a kid, like he always had stubble, and that feeling of him like giving you a kiss on the cheek, it was quite scratchy. And I remember the way his hair felt, and weirdly the way that his head smelt, which is, I think, from being a kid and being on his shoulders, like the smell of his head, sort of like a baby.
Mm.
About how babies' heads smell, but
it's crazy, right?
And when you smell a dad's head, it's a powerful emotion.
We fixate, I think, with memories, you kind of fixate on visual things, right? But the other senses, you kind of ignore sometimes when you do have a, like, just talk to you. Because I hadn't thought about the stubble thing only until I said it. I was like, it was really visceral. I was like, oh, yeah, I can really feel that stubble against my face. This kind of wanting to be kissed and also hating the stubble at the exact same time.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have anything to contribute. My dad was very warm. I remember him being very warm. That thing.
Yeah.
We had to share a bed once, and he was so warm, and it was like awful, really. It was like having a big hot water bottle in the bed with you, like a massive one, you know. It's just like, I can't sleep next to this man. How can anyone sleep next to how did two separate women find a way to you know, spend countless nights sleeping in the same bed as this gentleman? I have absolutely no idea. He was very warm, and it wasn't very pleasant. He did lots of farts, and he snored the whole night. It was the worst night's sleep, honestly. Worst night's sleep anyone could ever really have. I don't know. I remember the warmth.
Yeah, that's something.
I guess I sort of remember the smell, but it wasn't a very pleasant one.
Yeah, unavoidably.
Unavoidable. That joke, really. Yeah,
quite a clammy man, I'm imagining. Sort of hot but wet.
Yeah, I mean,
hot wet dad. Hot wet dads is what we should have called this. The much more attention grabbing podcast title.
Everyone would be clicking.
That is crazy.
he was a very sweaty man. That's to say the least. He was a very sweaty man. I think I've certainly inherited the capability to sweat an inordinate amount. Although perhaps that would simply be due to me being a little bit fat. Anyway. anyway. It is nice. Because I have to say, when you started saying that your dad, you know, he died when you were 8, I started thinking, well, it might be quite difficult, because you might not have so many good memories with him if you were so young. But actually, it sounds like you really do have quite a lot of good memories. I think that's really, really nice.
Yeah, I'm fortunate that I have a good memory as well, in the sense of being able to remember these things. There's a lot of little milestones that I remember, like my first adult McDonald's meal.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so my first non-happy meal was on Kilburn High Road McDonald's. So each time I drive past there, if I ever drive past there, like, that's where I had my first chicken sandwich in there.
Nice. chicken sandwich for your first one as well.
Yeah, the first one. I think because that was like my dad's favourite. So it's that thing, is dad eats my chicken sandwich. My mum was Filet-O-Fish. So he'd eat McChicken sandwich. Like, oh, I'm going to have what he's having. So, yeah, I'm going to have a McChicken sandwich. I remember being sat there and having that, being sat by the window, looking out on the high road and sat with my dad. I remember him kind of looking at me as if to think, is he going to be able to finish that burger? Of course I did. But...
Yeah.
Good work.
And do you have memories of, I mean, obviously you have memories of after he died, but sort of specific memories of missing?
Do you have any memories from after he died? Just in general.
The first
just...
8 years and then nothing.
Is there nothing left?
After
can
he
you
died,
not create
so
new
much,
memories?
So much grief. So much grief. I just stopped remembering things.
are there specific memories of moments where you missed him or where you really felt his absence?
Yeah, no, here you go. Wedding was one.
Well, I say we did quite a lot of things to bring him in, and we had, you know, I was wearing his socks. It's odd, isn't it? I think I've worn, but still, I was wearing his socks and sort of had one of his two of his ties that sort of got, well, his dad's tie as well. That one was one of them, and another one was one of his ties. Had the Marx Brothers on. Just so we had a couple of things like that. We did "You'll Never Walk Alone," yeah, sure. You know, the big Liverpool song. We had them sing it and everyone sang along. It was really nice. So we baked quite a few little things in like that to try and make him a part of it without doing any of the really big obvious gestures like having an empty chair at the table. Did you did you do that sort of thing to include
him? So listen, my dad was a singer. Yeah, so he was a singer, so we played one of his songs. I'm not sure when we played. We played like in the reception bit and stuff, and my mum immediately clocked when the song started playing and stuff. So so we did that. Obviously mentioned him in the wedding program. But yeah, that was it. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't anything big and elaborate, like having an empty chair or anything like that. And he was mentioned in speeches a few times. That was the sister I was talking about, who was there when he passed away. In her speech, I didn't expect it. Out of everyone, she's the one who spoke about my dad the most. And so it immediately took me back to the moment he died. I was like, oh, I was such a prick. Because when I was born, because like my brother and sister is like much older than me. She was 14 when I was born. So she's the one who has the clearest memory of my birth, because my mum was heavily sedated. I was born by a cesarean. And my dad obviously isn't about to recant his stories. So all the stories I know about my dad at my birth all come through my sister.
Right.
And stuff. So So when she was telling stories and stuff and she did her speech, that was probably the most moving speech I had at the wedding. And I guess it was probably because she was talking about my dad so much in the speech. So yeah, that made him feel like he was there in the room, kind of thing. Because she kind of gave accounts of what she thought he would be thinking in this moment. So yeah, it's nice.
That's really nice.
What kind of stuff did she say? If it's not too personal to ask,
just the thing of, you know, she'd be bit out here how proud he'd be of me, and that, you know, saying that you know, when I was, soon I was born, he said that I was too pretty to be his kid. and she said that he was obsessed with how pretty I was as a baby. That's you used the word pretty as well, so it was funny. And she basically said, you know, you've grown up to be like such a a great young man, kind of thing she was saying, and he would be really proud of you. It's that kind of thing she was saying. It was nice. Yeah,
I think if you compared the three of us as babies, I have no doubt that you would win, but that's partially because comparing the three of us now, I think it's just...
Yeah, I think you're still winning.
It's just, we're just nowhere near. The moment you came on the camera, I was just like, oh no, we can't have someone this more attractive than us on the podcast.
And he's on the
nightmare.
Worst camera as well. That's the thing. Like, we've got all the advantages.
I've been on three different cameras. We've three different cameras since you've been on.
All we've been trying to do is make you look worse. We're like, okay, we've got to do something to this guy. Like, you know, maybe you could do it with a podcast with a bag on his head. You know, we'll get some likes on Instagram, but is it worth it? That's what I say. That's such a lovely thing. For me, on the wedding day, some nice things, but it was after it that I really did start to think, you know, oh, it would have been nice if he was there. Did you have a similar kind of thing where it was actually after the event you start to think, oh, you kind of like looking back on it, it would have been nice he was there, or did you kind of feel it in the moment?
I think I felt it in the moment. Like similar thing. I didn't dwell on it too much in the moment either. I just thought it would be nice if he was here. I mean, I heard speeches and stuff. Then I kind of just moved on, because I guess it would be hard for me, because I lost him, like I said, as a kid. It was kind of hard. It's hard for me to conceptualize what our relationship would be like as adults. There's like two men. So I don't know what that is. I don't know what that would feel like. So I think that's why I think it's different. Where if you are, you're an adult when you lose your dad, then it's more of a thing. Yeah, as a man, I would have liked him to be there going through this experience I'm going through as a man, whereas I was a boy when I lost him. So going through this experience as a man, it's like I don't even know where my dad fits in. It's only when I see my friends with their dads, that's when I get that kind of sense of, oh man, that's what I'm missing out on. That looks great. That does, like, you know what I mean?
But I suppose there is the, I mean, for the people like myself and Rich, whose dads died when we were older, there isn't really a replacement father figure that comes in. You've sort of grown too old for there to be a replacer. Whereas if your dad dies when you're 8, I suppose there is scope for another father figure to appear from the ether somewhere to sort of give you some of that classic dad advice. Did you have a sort of another father figure when you were growing up?
Not an individual, just kind of an amalgamation of different people. So my two older brothers, my two of my uncles. So if there's anyone else, I think that's it. Maybe one of my godfathers as well. I just kind of, didn't go to them as like father figures or anything like that. But I just kind of watched how they moved as men and kind of thought, right, this is what you do, this is what you don't do. And it was, I kind of pieced them together as, why, like, this is what a good guy does. I should have a job like him and then treat my wife like that. And but while single, I should be as cool as him. And then I should probably go to the gym and do that. So kind of putting it all together like that. That's kind of what I did. I didn't have an individual who I looked to. If anything, it's more TV dads I looked at. Michael Kyle from My Wife and Kids, Uncle Phil from The Fresh Prince. those are the guys.
If you were going to choose a dad, Uncle Phil's one of the good ones, I think.
Yeah.
But then he died, and then you had to lose him all over again.
Yeah.
It's always...
But you'll always have Simon Wayans is still going, Phil. Right?
He is. He's still about.
And when he goes, there's so many other Wayans brothers that, I mean, we'll barely notice.
Yeah, exactly. We'll be fine.
That was the fantastic Darren Griffiths.
Well.
Oh.
Oh, I'm sorry, I came in too hard.
Oh, yeah, really, did you enjoy that episode? Yeah, I did.
I really enjoyed that. I thought that was good.
It was. It had been overshadowed in my memory by the myriad tech problems, but when I was going back through editing it, I was like, that was fun. He's a fun guy to talk to, and he's very insightful and he's very funny. If you'd like some more of Darren's insight and humour, he has just recorded his special. So the show that he did in Edinburgh last summer, which was very well received, he has recorded that. He recorded it at the Pleasance quite recently, and that will be coming out in June on Men's Health Week, leading up to Father's Day. So that would be, I believe, the week commencing the, I want to say, 8th. Nope, that's wrong. I want to say 10th. It's whatever week that is. It'll be coming out.
Father's Day. Just put Father's Day into Google.
Yeah. And the week before.
So we promote things now.
Just Google Father's Day, then Google Darren Griffiths, then go on YouTube. Google YouTube. Click on the link to YouTube. and put in Darren Griffith's Inconceivable, or probably even easier than that, follow him on Instagram at Darren Griff. Darren Griff.
Just put Darren Griffith's Instagram into Google. Yeah. Just do that. You don't you're not going to type a link based on what we're saying. Just put it into Google. You've got phones.
We're sort of deconstructing the plug, aren't we, here? Every time, every week, Tom's just like, just fucking Google it, man.
Just Google it, though. If you liked him, pop him into Google and listen to more of him. God. He was great. If you found that funny, do it again.
Exactly.
That's all you need. That's all you need. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you had a good time.
Yes.
As we did too. Now, Rich wants to take the stand here because Darren isn't the only man whom you can see stand in front of a microphone on stage.
Yeah, but just Google me, for God's sake. Just put my name into Google. You'll find it.
His name into Google. If you do that, will you come up? Are you famous enough for that?
I think I am now the number one Rich Spalding.
Are you number one Rich Spalding?
Certainly. I mean, have we discussed before that I also come up under a different search?
I forget what I was going to do.
Have I told you this? Right, let me check that it still works.
Is it if you Google? I don't know what to say. I don't want to be offensive.
Go onto Google now and put in the search term friendly male and then click on images.
What? No way. This must be just your Google. It can't be everyone's Google. You can't be the friendliest male. Friendly male images. I'm looking. Oh my God.
There I am.
Rich is the number 5 friendliest male on Google.
Which is a shame because at one point I was number 1. There was a point where my picture was the first thing that came up, but I've dropped behind 4 friendlier men, at least one of whom I would say is not friendlier than me. He looks quite sinister.
So, this is unbelievable.
I know. It's really weird. I found that out because a guy that I used to work with was putting together a presentation and wanted a picture of a friendly man. So he Googled friendly male and then sent me the link and was like, why is your picture here?
What? I mean, there's so much going on. I can't believe we didn't know what we were going to talk about in this. I could talk about this for an hour.
I can't believe I haven't told you this before.
I mean, what I really like is, and I assume as a listener, you now have Googled friendly male as well. Looking at what we're looking at. There are 2 kinds of friendly male. That's what Google is saying here. And one kind looks exactly like Rich. The same haircut, the same beard colour, length of beard.
Yeah.
Most of them glasses. The other one is an athletic black man. That's the 2 kinds of friendly male that exist, according to Google.
Yeah.
There's very, very few others in the mix here.
There's friendly white man and friendly black man. Those are the only 2 friendly men that exist. Apart from, for some reason, someone on dreamstime.com who's... Are you getting him as well? The guy in the blue polo shirt? I don't like his vibe.
If you open him up, he looks a bit like Phil Dunphy, like Ty Burrell.
Oh, I don't know. I'm getting more sort of your friend's creepy stepdad vibes off this guy.
He looks like he'd be a bit too friendly.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think he is overly friendly male.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my... Yeah. Annoyingly, that's the best bit of SEO I have on the internet.
And it is also, if I may add, when you click on... You, friendly male, for your, as you say, best bit of SEO on the internet.
Yeah.
What would be great then is if that came up with your Twitter,
links to our previews, reel, anything like
something
that.
Like this.
Yeah.
Instead, it comes up to an advertisement for you as a flatmate.
Yeah, my spare room
and it's
profile.
Fair to say you're pretty off the market to be someone's flatmate at this point as well. So.
Things would have to go quite drastically wrong for me to need to fire up that particular page again.
Is £750 a month still a reasonable budget for you?
I think I can manage that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Weird, isn't it? I don't know why that's happened. But it does work. So do Google friendly male, and then when you finish Googling friendly male, maybe Google Rich Spalding and then put in comedian just to be extra sure that you're not getting some guy who I think used to work for BlackBerry as the other one. Because I've got some previews coming up. If you're based in either London or Manchester, you can see me doing my show, Gather Your Skeletons, which I'll be doing at the Edinburgh Festival this summer at the Pleasance in the Cellar, 9:15, 31st of July to the 26th of August. So again, if you're in Edinburgh, come along. But if you want to see it before it's good, then I'm doing a show in Manchester on the 16th, Father's Day, ironically. So if you're Manchester based and you want to bring your dad along and remind him of his mortality, then 16th of June at Creatures in Manchester. And then in London, I'm going to be doing the Comedy Cabin in Hoxton on the 22nd of June at 5:30. So a little afternoon show. Please come along to that. I've had two previous shows at the Comedy Cabin in Hoxton cancelled because I didn't sell any tickets. So it would be lovely to lovely to get at least one person to this one. And I've reached the point now where I do just do the shows. Even if there's only one person there, I'll do the show. I did a show in Brighton recently, sold no tickets, went along anyway, dragged in eight people. Three of them left before the end. Wow. Two of them left in tears at the end. But in good tears, they were moved by the show, and three of them reacted like normal people and laughed, which is good. Which is good.
Did they pay at all?
No, I actually said.
So you can get it for free if you like. Just go to the show and you won't have to pay either. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, but I mean, I would really love it if people would buy tickets in advance, just so that I don't feel quite so awful on the day. So that's 22nd of June. Then Sunday, the 7th of July, I will be doing a show at the Pleasance in London. So the Pleasance in Islington. That's a really lovely room. And it'd be great to get lots of people to that. It's really fun to do it there. And then I've got another one on the 22nd of July, the final preview before Edinburgh. And that's with my good friend, Alexandra Haddo. We'll be doing both of our shows back-to-back at West End Comedy Club. So if you're free for any of those, just Google me. Google me, find the ticket links. All the links are in my bio on Instagram. You know how it is. And yeah, come along. It would be very nice to see you. I think the show will be good.
Why on your...
Such a long gap there.
Why on your spareroom.co.uk profile does it say you won't live with an over 50-year-old?
Have I...
Because I understand why you won't live with an under 18-year-old. That's fine. It's allowed.
I haven't written... Have I written that in as I will not live with an over 50-year-old?
At the upper age range, you would put 50 as your max.
Interesting. I don't know what particular issue I have with the over 50s community. Or that I had as certainly as a 28-year-old. I didn't feel like they were my ideal flatmates, maybe. A 49-year-old, not a problem. As soon as you hit the big 5-0, get out of my house. That's what I've always said. Yeah.
Is it because you fear that they're a bit too close to death for you?
I wouldn't like to think that 50 is too close to death for me, personally.
The thing is, though... We do know that death comes for us all.
But it comes for the over 50s first.
Good night!
Bye.